Thursday morning, at the corporate time. So if you get people Maybe I have to shut it too properly. And that's the east of the left before reading. Because I was thinking on that side, it's also major. But please just keep in mind that we can only start at 2.
Oh, you have caucuses too. I thought it's only as well as caucuses. I didn't know. Thank you for entering me that information. No, I think the meeting is at 2, Honorable Fundamental. Is it at 2? Yeah, so it won't clash with your meeting. I need somebody just to take us through what we went through last time. But if we can do just a little bit of just very carefully, and then so that we
well, in the last meeting, not only the last one, all the meetings that were, we dealt with many of the issues in the NRA, except the clauses that were left the last time around the issues of violence, the issue of labor broadcast, Table Employment Agencies, the issues around violence and strikes, and those are the issues. And in the last meeting, it was agreed that we would put all of those issues and the other issues that the department was proposing into the A list and highlight them differently so that members can see them. And my colleague Williams has done the A list and submitted it. Maybe she should take us through that process of the A-list and indicate what are the new areas that are new, and I'll explain those areas that from the department that we're putting in.
You're comfortable with that, we will do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. As Mr. Pelletier said, the department has said the committee has also requested colors, so I said the colors. For the committee, the black font, the draft in the black font indicates amendments proposed by the portfolio committee based on previous deliberation, not amendments agreed to, just the ones proposed. The ones in the blue font is amendments proposed by the department, which was deliberated in the committee on 23rd of April. The purple font indicates the alternative to Clause A. The proposed alternative which we were requested to read so we can come up with a proposal. The green font indicates amendments proposed by the Department of Labor which was not deliberated by the portfolio committee. Those are the concerns at the end of the meeting when the department has informed the committee that there are some changes which they want, the points which they want to discuss. So the committee requested that we put it in. And then the committee will look at all together at the same time, okay? The first clause is an amendment to Section 3 of the Act. Okay. Chairperson said, should I go through all the clauses, even the ones which were proposed by the committee today, or should I just go through the clauses, the new clauses that was not yet discussed and deliberated by the committee?
What do you want to remember,
My proposal is that we go through the new clause, which were not flattered through the, to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. I will start with the one. The That should be the one. Sorry. That will be the one in the green. Yeah, the green font. The one in the green font. I propose for the department. Okay. The first one is in clause 11. Clause 11 of the bill, which is on page 7 of the bill. Clause 11. On page 7 in 951. After services to insert and maintenance services. According to the department, this is a clause that was proposed by the Essential Service Committee, which is a technical amendment. I'm not sure if it's possible to speak to this one.
Yes, Chair. The maintenance levies, the law as it stands now, if you look at Section 70 dealing with the essential services, there are three areas in terms of what the essential services can do. It talks to minimum service level agreements, it talks to maintenance services, and the only thing that we are doing, we are aligning the present provision of the law, because essential service committees can also approve maintenance services is the opposite of essential service. In that, a company can apply to be given maintenance service status. What that means is that if you've agreed a breach of agreement on maintenance services, those workers who are in maintenance, I'll give an example in the mines. You must pump out water from the mines, and if you don't do that, the mine might collapse. Or in the glass industry, you've got boilers and furnaces that cannot stop. That must work 24 hours. If you stop it, it gets hardened and it destroys the whole machine. Now, a company can apply for that section to be regarded as a maintenance service. And when it is a maintenance service, those workers cannot go track on maintenance services. But the other workers can go on strike for those workers, and then the employer is prevented in getting replacement labor for those workers who are going out on strike for the workers on maintenance service. That's what maintenance service is. Now, the proposal that is put here by the Essential Service Committee is that this section, if you look at Section 6+1, it talks about the powers of the Essential Service Committee, and it says that the Essential Service Committee must monitor and observe the implementation of the essential service determination, their decisions that they are making. They must also monitor minimum service level agreements and their determination. What they are including there, they are including that also maintenance services agreements that have been reached, they must also monitor that. That's the change that they are making. But the present law already talks to maintenance services. It's not a new process that's been introduced, other than that, to make sure that they monitor also the implementation of those agreements. That's what it's close to. It's not an omission that was made to the amendment.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. Chair, we would just like to make on the ILS, from what the colleague said now, a technical comment, but perhaps just to contextualize that the committee, I think before recess, instructed us, as well as our colleagues from the department and the statutory advisors, to look at the proposed ILS amendments that Mr. Mugaliki is now presenting. And some of the technical changes that we have noted now in ALS that were agreed upon from a legal basis haven't been included. So the Commission Chair, we're just going to interject at certain stages the comments on what our colleagues said. For purposes of clarity, when one reads line 58 on page 7 then of the amendment bill, from our discussions we had, it was initially agreed from a drafting perspective that it shouldn't be and maintenance services, but it should read determinations, comma, minimum services, comma, maintenance services, agreement, and determination. So if the committee agrees with that clarification and that cleanup, that can perhaps just be added into the draft A list. Page 7 here of the bill, line 51. And it's with clause 11 in the A list. So that's the green part in the first section of clause 11 in the A list reads after services, instead and maintenance services. From a technical perspective, we're just proposing that it's not and, but merely minimum services, comma, maintenance services, comma, agreements, and determination. It's otherwise you're going to have a double and.
It makes a lot of sense. Then agreement to the members. Sure, let's move on. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. And then the next one is on page 10 of the bill, in line 51. to omit mediation and to substitute conciliation. These were one of the clauses proposed by the CTMA. Can you possibly see the breaking of them?
It's just a technical issue. I mean, the CCMA is often think that conciliation is more an involved and better word to use in conciliation, in conciliating these processes. And it's just a technical amendment. They think that it's going to cater to the parties because most of the time when parties go to the CCMA, they talk about conciliation. And that's what the CCMA is raising there. The clause that this stands raised there in 1951, they refer the matter to mediation at the Commission or Bargaining Council. If you look at just below 950, it says permit either party to refer the matter to mediation. They want that mediation to raise to conciliation at the Commission either way. It's page 10, Chair, at the bottom there, after 72, 50, if you look at that 50, just for that 50, the sentence started to permit either party to refer the matter to. Yeah, they are suggesting that that mediation must be changed to conciliation.
And any comment from the legal team and members? Okay. Is it agreed?
Yes, I agree because that
didn't affect it. Okay, we're together on this one. Continue.
Thank you. The next one would be a proposal limit to clause 17. That's on page 12 in line 4. The Labour Court may order that, and then they're saying to omit an administrator and to substitute a suitable person who may be a commissioner. So they want to propose that the Labour Court may order that a suitable person who may be a commissioner be appointed to administer a trade union or employee organization on such conditions as the Court may determine. Okay.
So this is not another technical amendment that the CCMA is putting. Look, as it stands, I mean, our view when we debate it, an administrator can be someone who's who might be a commissioner, but they want to bottle it down to indicate that a suitable person may be a commissioner instead of just writing administrator. And that's another technical amendment that they are putting in to make sure that the law states that a commissioner might be appointed as an administrator. Indeed, this section is the section that deal with the administrator for trade unions. If the registrar believes that the secretary or the secretary or office bearers of this trade union are abusing the organization, they are not doing what the organization was set for. For example, they are taking the money for themselves and all of those issues. The register then, in terms of this section, can go to the labor court and ask the court to appoint an administrator or administer this. Or sometimes we find out there's infighting between the same union. The union cannot function, it cannot deliver or did a financial statement to the register. The register go in. The proposal is the labor court must appoint an administrator. Technically, that administrator can be, without saying it, can be a commissioner, depending what the court is saying, but it remains of the view that it is far better when parties in the labor market know that who any person who will be appointed might be a commissioner, and it might give confidence to parties that because they deal with commissioners on a daily basis, then somebody else who's outside the environment. That's what this is all about.
What if the commissioner is not there? Then you bring somebody. Won't people feel that they were given the second best?
What happens is that there are many commissioners in the CCMA. I mean, the chance of a commissioner not being there, you've got about more than 500 commissioners. And the section as you said, it does not confine it only to commissioners. What it does, it's going further and say that the person appointed might be a commissioner. Not necessarily that you cannot appoint somebody not a commissioner.
Thank you, colleague. On
honorable members, the legal team.
Mr.
Lewis.
Sorry.
Just for the, no, just for our record so that you know who is speaking on this.
Thanks, apologies. As Mr. Mugaliki noted, we had raised in that meeting with our colleagues that an administrator usually is a suitable person. But if the committee so wishes to clarify it further, we have, there's no legal objection to it.
Honourable members, are we comfortable with this? Okay, this, yeah. Williams.
Thank you. The next amendment is one to clause 23 of the board.
Yeah.
On page 13, right at the bottom.
Yeah.
From line 54 to omit paragraph D, to omit that existing paragraph D, and to substitute it with may in the absence of any party of good cause shown.
Chair, this is another more emphasis on the clarification on this. Remember, when we were, the last time when we were debating this issue, if you look at the Act as it is, section 134 in terms of the Act, it does indicate on what grounds can you vary award of the CCMA. And there was a need by neither parties to include another ground, which is on good cause shown in the absence of the other party. If an award is given in your absence and you're able to show good cause why you were not there in that meeting, you should be able to use that very. The changes that are made there, what is in the Act now, the good cause is wider than what is being proposed by the intention of the parties. Bennett Network was confined it to awards that are issued in the absence of the other party, or, and if that party is able to show good cause. And that's what it is doing. It's already there, the good cause, but it's wider than what is there. It was trying to re-emphasize it.
Thank you. Honorable members, the legal team.
That was as the facts in that meeting, and we are in agreement with our colleagues.
You comfortable, members, with it? Okay, thank you. Lam Williams.
Thank you. The next one is clause 26, which is on page 40. On page 14, we have to omit director and to substitute commission.
Okay.
We have these, the committee had a discussion on this previously, the same clause here, because director is defined, and director defined would be, director is defined to mean the director of the commission appointed in terms of section 118, subsection 1, and includes any acting director appointed in terms of section 119. So our previous discussions, we had discussions on this, and we said that director would mean the director as defined in this, and we felt that this accommodated what the intention was, because it means the director of the commission. It doesn't mean anybody else. Instead of having the commission, because it points to a specific person in the commission would be the director of the commission. And that is a discussion we previously had in the committee.
No director, you mean this?
No, definitely not that director.
This is also arising, this was a debate that we had at the network. Mr. felt very strongly, they even went to the public hearing on this issue, they were part of the public hearing. Our view is that this is a very important work to refer to individuals, their argument in the public hearing. They wanted it to refer to the commission. And as my colleague has indicated, as far as the department, the commission, the director is not here or there. At the end of the day, it ends with the director. The director is responsible for the commissioning. But the CCMA came back and proposed and said that, well, you might have a situation where if you refer only to the director, if it happens in KZN province and the convening commissioner want to do something urgently in terms of this, it means that the convening commissioner has got to go to the director, can't make that decision in the provincial sense in terms of disputes that are of public interest. And that's the only reason. There's no legal issue. There's no issue, but definitely should be raised whether should be referred to the commission who take that decision that is a dispute now of public interest. It refers to both disputes of Section 150. If it's a dispute, if the strike is prolonged, the strike in EFCOM and the strike becomes of public interest, then the director is able to bring them in back and say, come, let's talk on this thing to resolve this issue. And the system is going to refer to the commission with the director.
Thanks, Chair. I was just going to bring the committee's attention to Section 116 of the Act, which provides for the governing body of the Commission. If I may, can I read it up to the Commission? Okay. The Commission will be governed by the governing body whose acts are the acts of the Commission. So it's the governing body who governs the Commission. The governing body consists of 88 persons and 9 other members, each nominated by NEDAC and appointed by the Minister to hold office for a period of 3 years. It also consists of the director of the commission. Now we go to who is the director of the commission. The director of the commission is a member of the governing body only by virtue of having been appointed director and may not vote at meetings of the governing body. So the commission is governed by the governing body and the governing body consists of the director. So for that purpose, we were just of the view, it's nothing unconstitutional whether to put commission or director. But we felt if you put director, it's more focused to a specific, because of the responsibilities, it's more focused to a specific person, and since the director is part of the governing body of the commission. That was just the sentiments that we had. Thanks, Chief.
Thank you, Chair. Our office had, I know our colleagues heard the distinction is neither here nor there, but our office took a certain stance in that meeting. And we, from a legal interpretation point, have reservations. Because you're going to be creating a new line where the Act is specifically defined director. And it is, as my colleague has pointed out, the governing body of the Commission and its tasks are outlined in 116, but that's not the Commission, that's the governing body of the Commission. And between the governing body and the Commission itself, there is the director. And Section 118 of the Principal Act actually states that the director must manage and direct the activities of the commission. That is a responsibility that has legislatively been assigned to the director. He or she has been held responsible for that function. And as Mr. Minkalipi now said, there are situations where a commissioner may want to do something, but he doesn't want to go to the director. Whatever happens in a commission, then the director will have to account for that. For that reason, also 118 allows the director to delegate where he or she sees fit. And the director can then, in managing the commission, also set in place the structures within which the commission functions. As explained previously, it can be equated to the judge president of a court. A judge in a court knows where the boundaries are. He or she can't go outside the lines and do something without the judge president having put in place that structure or knowing what's going on in the court, because he or she ultimately is then held accountable. So from an interpretation point of view, it looks very easy to just merely substitute director with commission. But commission, then you sit with this vague interpretation already. It is governing body of the commission itself, it is the commissioner. The LRA is quite clear. The director is defined and is in the director's scope and functions, because that is initially first to 118. It says he or she manages and sets in place structure. And it's in that structure in the commission function, and that director then reports within the structure of the governing body. So there is that hierarchy. And from our office's point of view, changing that will create confusion and at the end of the day, possibly impact on the functioning and the structures as well.
Just want a technical amendment.
according to?
It's not just technical.
It's not just technical. We believe there is clear and where there's clear legal interpretive issues if we take a director and substitute it with the commission. So from our office's point of view, we are advising that the term director be retained to.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't want to agree with us retaining the term director because it focuses specifically, it gives direction to say this the director of the CMA. It does not leave any space. Because if you use commission, we've got so many commissioners and commissions in the CMA, we might just get confused who are we talking about. But if we speak specifically to the director of the CMA, this one would, my proposal is that we retain the director as is and just leave the commission for the commissioners and all the others that we can at least confuse at some point, but get back again on track.
Does it come from that where, in instances where the director is not there, can the director find somebody to go in on their behalf or what? Is there any those kind of... If it's like that, then... Dr. Lewis,
Within that structure and the power of managing, the director will be able to delegate, if he or she is not there, what his responsibilities are. And then also in putting in place the structure, those situations will be catered for. A process will be in place where if somebody is not there, somebody will step in, fulfill the function, almost like acting. You'll have your practical, normal acting position, situations and delegated by where necessary. Thank you, Chair.
So the director can send a commissioner, it's still fine, in case, but I think we, Brother, Honorable Uda.
You are pointing just me, because the director in managing the situation would do that, and whoever would be doing the job would be the team on the part of the director, so that means
and what it simply says is that it is the responsibility of the director, and that whatever happens is that the director's head that's going to go on the block, not of the person who are delegated to do that. It puts the responsibility at a very high level.
Thank you, and I agree with what was said also because of the role of director, the Labour Relations Act provides a provision for the acting director of the commission because it also clearly outlines, so we know anything happens to go. Section 119 of the Act provides that the chairperson of the governing body may appoint a suitable person to act as director whenever the director is absent from the public or from duty or for any reason is simply unavailable to perform the functions of director or the office of director is vacant. Only a senior commissioner may be appointed as acting director. An acting director is competent to exercise and perform any of the powers and functions of the director.
Thank you very much. Any comments from the member, the legal team? There's an agreement on this one. Can we move on to the...
So must act to request and to substitute in the absence of consent. I think the possible view was both on page 14, in line 44, to omit after request and to substitute with the consent, and on the same page 14, in line 45, to omit if there is no request and to substitute in the absence of consent. The department will discuss both together.
Yeah. Chair, I mean, this is another proposal from the CCMA. Remember, the CCMA works on the basis of their main compunction is to bring two parties together. And they also view that in deciding whether this is issue of public interest, the best attempt should be the party themselves agreeing. There must be consent instead of a request, a consent that they are raising. And then they say, if you go to 45, then they say, if there's no consent, then the third director then exercise her discretion because there's no consent and set it up. It's within the spirit of how the CCMA operates to try and bring consent on all the issues. Therefore, they are suggesting that it is a dispute of public interest that the parties can consent for the CCMA to come in and try and help them. If they cannot consent, the CCMA obviously will try. If they cannot consent on that, then the CCMA director will take that decision for themselves. And that's what this means. I think that the next ones will fall away in view of the decision that was taken on. 5 to 8 will fall away. 4 to 8, I mean.
I think we have an argument on this one. Is there any need? Let me move on.
Thank you. The next one is on page 40, in line 55, to omit subsection 3 and to substitute subsection 1. This is just the correction of the bill.
To retain an employee on in employment for an indefinite basis. You take our contract of employment then.
Thank you, Chair. Our office mentioned to our colleagues there in the peer meeting, we feel it's surprising that they're proposing to clarify, in essence, a little bit redundant, because it says employ employment. There's another other definition that you can give to somebody who's an employee, even if you're speaking from the organization or the company perspective, because to be an employee, you must be employed. So our position that this clarification is not necessary, it doesn't clarify, it just makes it more verbose, but that is for the committee to decide. Sure. It's a moot point, yes.
Yes, Chair, indeed, I decided to agree, because initially the issue was the use of the concept engaged, and they were saying we've got to get engaged out and indicate that the person is employed. So, yes, that's really what it is. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair.
Can I explain also, there are many kinds of employees. You find situation, this is what we're trying to clarify is this. You find situation people who are reinstated by the system presently as we speak, who you get dismissed, you are employed by a labor broker, you get dismissed. Labor broker go to the system and say, well, I have not dismissed him. He's still with my books. He's still registered with me. And this emphasis that we're making here, it's a retained employee in employment. That's the emphasis that we're trying to make to deal with that phenomenon of people being retained in the labor market in a list of possible employees. And they would argue that. And we've got many of those cases. And that's what this is trying to re-emphasize, that we don't go to there. And that's basically what it's trying to help to deal with. And that's why it's not taking away the word employee. It says after employee to emphasize that retain the employee in employment. If you take it, the explanation that I'm giving, that's what's happening in the labor market as we speak. There are many people that are reinstated in lists, not in actual employment. And that's the intention of the re-emphasize. I agree with my colleagues from in the Parliament that, look, under normal circumstances, when an employee will always assume that you are employed. But I'm trying to say to members that, remember that there are employees who are regarded as employees but who are not in employment, who are in list for a possible placement. And that's what this is trying to emphasize. When we talk an employee, in this case, we're talking when we say retain, not retaining someone else, you're retaining an employment. That's the emphasis that it's trying to make. Whether the members think that emphasis is necessary or not.
Them to be, this thing is very pregnant with me.
Sorry, Chair. As I indicated, I thought our concern was the use of the word again. Because to engage somebody, you could engage them, put them on your book. But if you employ them, they are in employment, then they are supposed to be working. I think that was what was supposed to be clarified. That these people are not just named in a book, but they are people who are employed, which means they get paid. I thought that was what we were trying to clarify.
Ms. Williams, and then I'll go over to Dr.
Thanks, Chair, I think with regard to this, yes, we can have the discussion in the general, if it had to be in the general context, employee would mean someone in employment. But because this relates to a specific aspect of employment and it relates to a specific aspect
of the employee. It comes to put emphasis that yes, you can have an employee, but the person must be employed, because many times people have, if you look at the section relates to the amendment of section 186, the meaning of this Muslim unfair labor practices, and then it goes to unfair labor practices. It wants to provide for people who are employees, as in terms of the definition of employee, but here they must be physically employed, because many times people get cyanide, people get, don't come to the premises, don't come to the office, but this wants to place, this wants to create a certain aspect in the interpretation. So when the court needs to interpret this, or the whoever needs to interpret this provision, they want to specify that this employee must be in employment. And I think that this basically in employment is usually used as an aid to provide when interpreting the word employee, or to specify what type of employee we're referring to here. And it's not just the employee in the general sense of employee. Thanks.
It's all the areas of the typical employment system contract around that area. And for us, there's no real difference among us on this issue. It's not about the law. This is about emphasis. If the emphasis is on to assist in the labor market to deal with any misunderstanding and dispute, I'll personally err on the side of more emphasis than less emphasis. And that's for us the issue that we're raising.
Thank you, Chair. I think with respect what Mr. Mkhaledi is trying to do with the emphasis, it's already retained in sub B, because as our colleague said, it falls within 100, in the primary, your principal act, it falls under section 186, which is the meaning of dismissal. That already contextualizes what we're trying to do here. We're trying to safeguard from dismissal in certain circumstances. And then if we read Roman numeral 2 with sub B, to which it speaks, it contextualizes in the bill then an employee employed in terms of a six-term contract on employment, reasonably expected the employer, and then it down to retain the employee. So your employed, which are then now duplicated in Roman numeral 2, is already under B when it says in terms of a six-term contract of employment. So that in employed class is already there within the general framework. And then Roman numeral 2 nearly defines it further, creates a further sub-situation. But we are of the opinion that it's still then you're creating that certainty, you're creating that contextualization and protection, but it's unnecessary to repeat it when further clarified, because it works in a hierarchy. B is here, B contextualizes, and then it just goes further and I add something on instead of just repeating and adding. I'm trying to find clarifying, but that is our position, Chair, and it's for the committee ultimately to decide.
So you've got no problem with what the country is suggesting, except that it will look a bit clumsy. But in terms of content and everything, there's no... The point of formulation. Are you comfortable with what they're saying about that the emphasis somewhere, or do you feel strongly that we need to have this emphasis on both?
As I indicated, Chair,
somebody may not see the emphasis.
As I indicated, Chair, that this is about emphasis. It's going to help many people out there who are not as legally good as all of us here, when the emphasis is clear that the expectation you're talking about of a fixed contract that you had was for you to be retained in employment. And then we don't see any damage. There's no legal issues here. There's no constitutional issue here. But we think that for people in your constituencies in the rural area who might raise this would understand more with the emphasis than without it.
The problem that you see when you write things like this, they are not only meant for people in rural areas. They are meant for other people, and particularly people who comment more about those who would be lawyers and practitioners in the field. So would be the people who will be agreeing along those lines, not necessarily the ordinary people. I mean, in front of their lawyer, it doesn't mean anything.
I'm not making it for the ordinary people.
No. It is made for ordinary people.
Yes.
But it will be written in such a way that it makes a lot of sense. Because if you're writing for ordinary people, what about those who are not ordinary too? Because the thing is, it's written for everybody.
I think maybe for the specific committee, the department maybe just clarify, for example, we currently have retained employee on an indefinite basis. So if we don't have any employment there, what are the other possible situations that the department is trying to avoid if we don't have any employment? Maybe the department can explain that. What we're trying to avoid, or what other possible interpretations are there, if there is another one, if there are other interpretations that maybe we should consider having.
I have indicated that our issue is that there are, as we think, in terms of the law, there are decisions for employees are retained in the list of temporary employment agencies, not in employment. And then the temporary employment agency would argue that, well, you're dismissed. You're on the list as soon as I get a contract with the chairperson company, and will be able to place you, therefore you are not dismissed, you are not here. And that is what the emphasis is trying to deal with, that the expectation of the employees. Remember, this section talks about expectation. I'm a fixed-term contract. I expect my contract to be renewed, and it's just emphasizing that expectation for me to be in employment, not in a list, and that's the issue that we're trying to... But, as you say, it's not about the law. It doesn't change anything other than for the emphasis and clarifying it. But it's up to the members.
I don't think this is going to change the pride of trade. But
just from what Mr. Kalitina said, talking about, because I just spoke about context, he started speaking about a situation where somebody has temporary employment terms but is not with a victim contract to somebody else because that says doesn't have the contract, then perhaps it is not the right clause to put that in, because you're contextualizing with sub B in saying that employed in terms of a fixed-term contract. So you're already creating the situation where that person is employed, and then you're delving into the details. From what Mr. Mkalipi now stated, he's speaking about a situation where that is not the case. There is no a contract, and that person is still on the list. It's perhaps something then that the idea is good and the purpose of protection is good, but maybe it doesn't fit here. If I just from the example provided, that's perhaps where the difference comes. We don't see it as necessary in the given context. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, honourable members. I think the decision is ours.
Thank you, Chair. I agree that you cannot define an employee in any other terms. You can't be an employee out of employment. And I think that's very important that we take that into consideration. But equally, how do we ensure that there is proviso for people who are kept on the list, and it's arguably employment because you're still employed, but you're not deployed. Yeah, you are technically employed because you appear on the employees register. I mean, on the employer's register of employees, but you are not placed in active work. So I think that provision we have to find a way that provision is made in the act. So I think if we could be if you could think about putting it, I mean, probably putting it in that way. I think if the concern is that people are on the list of the employer and being regarded as employees, but actually not earning remuneration, and that they have been involved in actual work in the past and are expected to be further deployed, but they are not. I think that we've got to find a way as to how do we make a provision for that in law. Otherwise, if there's no consequence, then why are we having this debate? If it doesn't change the provision, if the intention is to make sure that people can easily understand what the intention of that part of the amendment is, I'm sure there's somewhere else in the Act where we can make that provision, either in the explanation or wherever in the Act.
We are not writing our laws in Tamil. We write them in English. So they need to flow. We put it in English with them. Okay. What do we do, honorable members? I think we should just move this. I think we should put it, leave it as a passes vote, like the way he said, because it's not changing anything. And it's just that it looks clumsy. But if this clumsiness makes us easier for people to understand better than I don't think it's going to change the price of bread. Can we live with that? can we live with that amendment? With that emphasis, honourable members, or should we? Remove this too much emphasis. I mean, repetition. Let me say it was. It's not necessarily an emphasis, I think it's more repetition, which is meant to emphasize it.
Just to go back to what I said, engaged goes out, is that right?
Yeah.
Right, that's enough fun.
Let's move.
Thanks. So the committee is agreeing not to include any employment. Committee's proposing. Sorry?
Let it include.
Not to include.
No.
Oh, to include. So we're going to keep the employment.
As long as it agrees the...
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Is it reading in English? Can you read both of them and then so that we move?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. I guess that's what it means, because the dismissal means that... No, this is... I'm reading the whole thing from the Act, so you can see the whole thing instead of reading the tail end. Yeah. This is under Section 186 of the Act, the meaning of dismissal and unfair labor practice, which is heading. Then it goes on to... Dismissal means that an employee employed in terms of a fixed-term contract of employment is reasonably expected the employer to retain the employee on an indefinite basis, but otherwise on the same or similar terms as the fixed-term contract, but the employer offered to retain the employee on less favorable terms or did not offer to retain the employee. Now, with any agreement to read like this, dismissal means that an employee employed in terms of a fixed-term contract of employment reasonably expected the employer to retain the employee in employment on an indefinite basis, but otherwise on the same or similar terms as the fixed-term contract, but the employer offered to retain the employee on less favorable terms would he not offer to retain the employee?
Would you like to read yours and then so that we move on?
Thank you. The way we're proposing it was the first dismissal means that an employee employed in terms of a fixed-term contract of employment reasonably expected the employer to retain the employee on indefinite contract of employment, but otherwise the same or similar terms as the fixed-term contract, but the employer offered to retain the employee on less favorable terms, or did not offer to retain the employee. Our argument was merely to employee. You don't need the in employment. So our reading just drops the in employment. Thank you, sir. Thanks.
Thank you. I think the difference here is that when my colleague, my learned colleague, Barbara, Dr. Ruth, has said, yeah, she did contract of employment, and I think we moved to substitute contract of employment with basis. So to retain an employee in employment on any definite basis. But I think if you keep contract of employment, it gives a certain text to it or a certain context to it.
Okay, continue. Advocate Gordon.
I just want to perhaps come on record on this point. And I think that we have, in the meeting that we had during April, discussed this point. We labored the legal team on these issues. And in that meeting, it was decided that these amendments would not be proceeded with under Clause 35, if I recall correctly. My notes were not supposed to. We agreed that the draft as it is in the introduced version of the bill shall remain. So it does seem as if we are in disagreement. This disagreement was clarified in April already, and it shouldn't have been before this committee. So that's just our view. We had this discussion. From our office, we indicated we were not in agreement with the employment or changing the contract of employment to basis. But the department and the statutory advisors are once again tabling these matters before the committee, even though we had already reached an agreement between ourselves on that point. Thank you, Chair.
You know, because then I was going to say, why moving to this thing because it was resolved? Now that it is open, then now it's where we are. So that's why we are dealing with this as we should move.
Thank you. Just to clarify, the amendment in green was the amendment at the last meeting that we had with the committee. After the committee did the minutes of the meeting right at the end, then the department had a document which they said these are some of the amendments which want the committee to consider as well. And it was instructions of this committee to drop the amendments, to include it in the A list, but to provide for it in a different color. And that is these amendments that the department has given us. So this was acting on instruction of this committee from our last, that the instruction we received at the last meeting. Thanks. So the next one could be on Clause 41. On page 20, in line 28, after employees to insert, irrespective of the number of employees who are dismissed. Thank you.
This is another emphasis that we're making. Remember, this section deals with retrenchment. Presently, all retrenchment cases go to CCMA for conciliation, from CCMA to the Labour Court. The CCMA cannot arbitrate. We're making changes in the law, and one of the changes is that if an employer employed less than 10 employees, doesn't matter how many employees they retrenched. Presently, the law talks about if you retrench one or two, you might go to that area. And there's been a lot of confusion in the labor market where you find out the employer wants to retrench one or two, but give notice to 20. Therefore, the intention is to retrench 20, but they end up retrenching two. As a result of that, those employees cannot go to the CMA because the intention of the government was to retrench more. If you're trying to take out any disputes about whether can these employees go to arbitration or not, and it's giving again the evidence that explain that if you employ less than 10 employees, irrespective of the number of people that retrench urgently, if you employ less than 10, the system may have contribution to arbitrate that case. And that's the first. So that there are no disputes about the number of people that have been retrenched.
Thank you, Chair. We were in agreement with our colleagues on that issue.
Then I'm going to play that in the issues that we agreed upon somewhere. Let us not rehash them in a meeting. Okay.
I think it's for our own benefit.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, it doesn't matter whether we agree or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, where are we now?
Page 11, on page 21, in line 22, after and to insert the fact that, in page 22, after and to insert the fact that, and on page 21, in line 22, after service to delete that. So it will start with the fact that.
This comes in, if you look on the document at page 21, the sentence that starts with end, and the sentence before the last that starts with end, is, and then it's trying to emphasize that they need to raise the fact that the temporary employment services, that is not registered, will not constitute a defense. That's what you're trying to say. The fact that temporary employment services is not registered, that will not constitute a defense. That's the English and the grammar that's trying to clarify there in that word.
On page 21, in 944, after services to insert as contemplated in subsection 1, so it's performing a temporary employment services as contemplated in subsection 1 for the client is the employee of the temporary employment services in terms of section 1 and 82. This would be linking it to the temporary employment service in subsection 1.
It's just including the reference that should have been there. That's actually, if you look after 2A, performing temporary services as contemplated, because section 1 talked to what a temporary services is, and that's what the addition is trying to do, referring you back to that one.
Are we all happy this night?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Yes.
I thought you still were
okay, I didn't know.
No, the chair,
I mean, it came earlier.
Yeah. So, okay, the next one. Which is still on page 21, isn't it?
Yes. On page 21, from line 46, to omit paragraph B, and to substitute foreign paragraph B, should be not performing such temporary employment services, not performing such temporary services for the client is, subparagraph 1, deemed to be the employer of that client, and the client is deemed to be the employer. And paragraph 2, to be not performing such temporary employment services for the client that is subject to the provisions of section 198B, employed on any debtor's basis by the client. Thanks.
So just to try and explain where this is coming from. B as it stands, we're trying to re-emphasize B. As it stands, as far as we're making it clear, if you look at B, it starts with not tackling temporal employment, so the same thing goes on there. But then we're adding another category that indicates that if you're not performing temporal employment services, you are deemed to be employed by the client. Remember, subsection 1 indicates what temporal employment services is. It says you employ for fixed and correct, and all those issues that are there for 6 months, or all the issues that are there that you still have got to debate with. And this section is linking with that one. It says if you are deemed to be either not performing temporal services, then you are deemed to be employed by the client, and the client is the employer. If you do not fall under that category, 6 months, whatever you agree on, and all those issues. If you don't fall there, you're outside there, let's say you are 7 months, therefore you are employed by the client. If you are 8 months or you are not anything that section deals with, it's making it clear that you are then employed by the client. And then it says that also you might not be a temporal employment service, but you might be employed on a fixed-term contract in terms of Section 198B. Remember, 198B regulates fixed contract. It says you can work on a fixed-term contract for 6 months, or if you are on a, what is this, temporal employment, seasonal worker, and all of those issues that are written there in 1AD. And this now linked to that. You could be employed on a fixed contract if you meet the requirement of 188B. That's the linkage that is made there. So that if there's any dispute, the employer can't say, no, this employee is not on a temporal employee. It does not meet the issue of temporal employee, but is on fixed contract. Then when you adjudicate that dispute, you're going back to fixed term contract. Well, if it's on fixed term contract, it's got to meet the terms of 198B, which deal with the fixed term contract. That's the linkage that is in there.
Okay, agreed. Okay, can we go to the next one, which is still on page 21?
Thank you. On page 21, in line 49, of the client to insert whether at the instance of the temporary employment service or the client. Let's read the termination by the temporary employment service of an employer's assignment with a client, whether at the instance of the temporary employment services or the client, for the purpose of avoiding the operation of subsection 3B. Is it dismissal? Thanks.
Just also to explain, this is also about protection of workers. You've got interesting instances. Remember, we made the example of this instance where I'm a labor broker. I'm employed by Honorable Nyakemba to cut his business contract. and I employed Honorable Malamela, my employee, to guard Honorable Nyakemba premises. And for whatever reason, Honorable Nyakemba asked Honorable Malamela to wash his time. And Honorable Malamela says, no, much easier to cut the premises. And then Honorable Nyegema says to me, the Labour Broker, I don't know what man here. He must be out of this business. Now, I don't have a problem with him, but the client has got a problem with him. The client insists that we dismiss. This is trying to make sure that if you dismiss, whether at the instance of me as a Labour Broker or as a client, you are dismissed. It doesn't matter who is said. That's what is trying to close the problem that is trying to close that in the labor market. And then giving those workers who are in that situation the power to be able to go. So that I don't have the labor resource say, I don't dismiss you. It's my client who doesn't want you. I want you, therefore you are not dismissed with me. I will look for a job for you and place you somewhere else when I get it. And the law is making it clear that in that case, then you are dismissed. That's the issue that I'm trying to deal with.
Good. Next.
Yeah. So it is when we need that, I think it is item 14 and 15 together. So should the committee propose that amendment for the termination by the temporary employment services of an employee service with a client, whether at the instance of the temporary employment service or that client, for the purpose of avoiding operation of subsection 3B, or because the employee exercised the right in terms of the act, is a dismissal.
Agreed.
Next.
The next one is on page 23, 98. Yeah. After the 9 in brackets, subsection 9, after that would be to omit and to substitute the following. So it will read, and from the commencement of the Labour Relations Amendment Act 2013, an employer must provide an employee. And it continues reading that sentence.
Good. Okay.
The next one is on page 23 in 956. To omit the, basically to omit the full stop and to substitute a comma. The reason for that would be listed item 38 would be read with listed item 39, which would be on page 23 after line 56 to add the following. So the full stop would be a comma. So it applies to a part-time employee employed before the commencement of the Labour Relations Amendment Act, 2013, and comes into operation 6 months after the commencement of the CA Act.
Yeah. Those are those transitions. Remember we had a long debate about transitional arrangements, and we were asked by the meeting the last time that we meet and come up with an agreed formulation of this, and these are the formulations that we agreed on in to ensure that obviously the 6 months will depend on whether the first 6 months you agreed on. This 6 months basis on the basis that it's talking about temporary employment services and talking about fixed term contract, and it says that the law comes into operation. Remember, you must have a transitional arrangement. You can't treat innocent and South African people who intended to act illegally by introducing a legislation that all of a sudden makes their action that they took, which were legal, then illegal. And that's what it's trying to do. The issue of the 6 months, as we said, is linked to the 6 months that is at the beginning. You might, it depends what you do with that 6 months. If you want to make 12 months or 24 months or 1 month or 0 months, whatever it is. Yeah. the principle is the transitional arrangement.
Okay.
And that should be it.
Sorry, I keep coming to all the money. Use the word stigma instead of letter pain. Do you like it?
No, we
recommend that we use X.
Period, 6 months to launch the dispute, that will be coming up. that the parties, workers will be able to not dispute even after 6 months. In terms of the law as it stands, ordinary dispute, you've got 30 days to launch your dispute. I mean, these are the issues that if members want, they can say, well, it should fall in line with other disputes. And there is a precedent in the law where certain cases have got longer time. If you look at the three issues on discrimination, you've got 90 days to refer your cases of discrimination. When other cases of misconduct is 30 days, but discrimination, you can, after 90 days, still bring a case of discrimination in terms of the Employment Equity Act, which in terms of employment request, in terms of this section. This is what this section is trying to say. It's saying these cases, about all these cases that they are about inequality, you know, about the issue of 18A, that is temporary employment, and 18C, which talk to those workers who are part-time employees, the issue about part-time employment and all those issues. And that's what it's trying to do. But it's a decision of the members who think it's a little bit clear. But the issue that I'm raising is that the difference here with the ordinary section in the law, the section now deals with 30 days. Here we think, well, you should give it more time because of the complexity of this issue in bringing your case.
Okay. I think we spoke about it in the last sitting, and there was I think what asked you to do the formulation, which is what we have here. Do we want to get into that discussion? Do you want to? Do you have one? Yes.
Yes. Maybe from age.
No, it's done. It's not maybe.
Now, I'm trying to listen. The 90 days is after conciliation failed to resolve the dispute. Meaning that within 90 days, the matter must be finalized through arbitration. Now, you are making reference to other dispute that has to be resolved within 30 days. Can you clarify yourself in that? Because you are also featuring in. I know the 6 months is something that we are still going to talk about it. But sitting here reasoning this for argument's sake, if then, in deliberating on section 189A, we don't agree on 6 months, we agree on 1 month for argument's sake. Will that everything change in 1 month then?
Chair, this is totally different from that. It's got nothing to do with that part. This is about where we say that if an employee and I've got a dispute, this gives 6 months to launch the dispute. I've got time, 6 months to launch the dispute. Presently, the law in an ordinary misconduct case, you've got, I think, 10 days to launch your dispute with the CMA. This gives you more time. Sometimes people realize later that the unfairness has taken place. Now I want to launch a case. Instead of the system, they say, well, you must apply for condemnation. We are out of jurisdiction on this issue. In this case, it proposes that you've got more time, basically. It's not saying that the case has been resolved within 6 months. It says that you've got 6 months to launch your case from when the case happened. It's even, that is giving more time. And then it says that under arbitration, then the CMA has, you've got there under arbitration, there are two areas there. Under arbitration, you've got, first, you've got 90 days to refer your case to arbitration. Everything else is the same as out of the section, but it's giving more time in these cases for employees to refer their cases. And there's no need for it to be linked to that other 6 months to change when that changes. It's got nothing to do with that. It's about where workers can bring cases that are 6 months old into the system. And that's what it's giving. And whether workers can, after 9 months, bring cases for arbitration in this area to the CFMB.
Okay. So, in essence, this section deals with how disputes that emanate from the implementation of Section 198A, B, and C should be dealt with, specifically disputes in relation to it. I think it's because in the last meeting there was this thing that the provision time period will be linked to 6633 and I think that was there. And I think that's why that question.
If we also take into mind that 108A, capital A, B, and C is a new area of law that's been created through this amendment bill, and also the fact that it's the area that are introducing that relates to lower income earners. And usually when we are dealing with lower income earners in reality, we find that they don't know at the time when the dispute arises what their rights are. And then down the line, 4 months later, you bump into a friend of a friend of a friend who says, you could have done this, but then that month that the LRA gives in respect of your referral has passed. But I think that in this respect, perhaps the longer time period allows for that situation to protect rights.
Okay. Thank you. I think this was the last one for the... Oh, there's one more.
In terms of Section 13 of the a basic condition of employment act, and it gives the same meaning that employees, senior employees who are dismissed can expect an amount 6 times the basic condition of employment act as part of their compensation, and it introduced the issue of financial compensation then reinstatement. Basically, that's the principle of 1934-93. It says that if you are senior managers, you have 6 times, then the threshold of the DCA, you are dismissed. The remedy for you will be financial compensation. Basically, that's what it says.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to try not to rehash old arguments, but just to set our office position on the matter. The same arguments on which we advised the committee for the rejection of the original Clause 38, they retained the same concern they retained with the new section or proposed amendments to Section 193 and 194. For the reason that, as Mr. McGillicuddy just stated, it's because somebody earns a certain amount of money that remedies are exceeded. That's a very arbitrary way of determining if an unfair labour act was committed against you. Just because you earn a certain amount of money, you can't be reinstated. It blurs the lines in terms of labour law when it comes to the process of fire between dismissal for operational reasons, misconduct, and incapacity. It merely states, regardless of what happened, regardless of whether your dismissal was substantively unfair, Commissioner can then say, but you can see it's substantively unfair, you are actually under normal circumstances would be allowed back, but now in terms of this provision we can just give you money and wish you well on your way. That arbitrariness is to us it's still an unjustifiable infringement on the right to fair labour practices, because the Constitution doesn't say just specific people, it says everyone has the right to fair labour practices. If you want to limit that limitation must really be justifiable. And to merely say to somebody that because you're an earner of a certain income level that will be determined, you can't be reinstated. It must also be kept in mind that in terms of labour law, you will have situations where the commissioner or the labour court judge, when it comes to reinstatement, it's not automatically just if you win, you're reinstated. The court will look at whether the employment relationship between the employee and the employer is of such a nature that they can actually still work together. So they'll consider the impact on the business, whether that there is some sort of reconciliation that can take place, whether there is a breakdown in the relationship that they will just never be able to work together. And in that instance, then the judge or the commissioner will look at compensation as an option. So for us, the law as it stands at the moment caters for all those eventualities. As the memorandum to this will indicate, you get situations where people just can't work together. And if that is the reason, and that is the true reason for this amendment, the labour law already provides for that. The court can't force people to work together, it can't, to the extent that it will negative impact on a business. So from our office's point of view, we need to caution the committee that there is constitutional concern. We feel it's an arbitrary exclusion. It infringes on the right to fair labour practices, and we don't see the arguments presented as a enough justification to justify such an infringement. Thank you, Chairman. And then, yes, we must just mention that if the committee chooses to go against our advice, then in any case, these are amendments that weren't in the original bill. So this will have to go back to the National Assembly for permission to get published, run through the whole process of public participation again. And then we caution that these arguments that we're putting in front of you now will surely come back and will be rehashed again, but that's the committee to decide. But just to caution that if the committee goes with this amendment, the bill will basically have to be parked. And that clause will have to be reopened because it's such a high impact situation. Our rules don't allow for the process to go in further. So the committee's decision here will not only have a legal impact, but also a procedural impact that we need to advise on. Thank you, Jackie.
Yes, Mayor.
Thank you, sir. Sir, made of wood. So you are a chaplain, not just a chair. It appears that there will be limitations in certain categories.
of employees based on positions that they are holding at a particular time. And there's Section 36 of the Constitution that deals with limitations. Now, does the necessity of inserting this clause in line with Section 36 of the Constitution? Because if the Constitution deals with fairness, and we need to deal with fairness as the Constitution dictates, and if there will be limitations, obviously such limitations, in my view, should be in line with Section 36 of the Constitution. Now, my question is, when the department was looking at this, have you then looked at that? If yes, how are the chances of constitutional challenges being raised as a result of that? Thank you, sir.
We've looked at this. Our advice is that we can sustain constitutional challenge. Obviously, as we said the last time, there's no way in terms of law that we can force, you could prevent people applying to attack the law unconstitutionally. The issue is, can you sustain a defense under Section 36 in terms of limitations? And we think it can. In terms of this section, first, it does not deal with, it excludes issues of transfer. It deals with Section 187 only. And employees can argue for reinstatement. They've got to argue, obviously they've got to convince the court that there are special circumstances that justify re-employment for them, reinstatement, not only financial, or this. Therefore, the discretion is there, you can make that argument. And in the law presently, there are limitations to reinstatement. There are limitations already. The limitation that is in the law now is not on what you earn. The limitation in the law is on the nature of the unfairness. Presently, the law says that if your unfairness is procedural, then your employer has just come in this morning and say, I don't want you here, out of here. You had a cost you attended stealing, and they say, out of here, I'm dismissing you. They don't give you a hearing and all those issues. You go to the CCMA, and the CCMA find out that, yes, you did steal, but you were dismissed unfairly. The employer does not follow the procedure. But we're not reinstating you because the law says we can't reinstate you. We will give you financial compensation. Therefore, what we're saying is that there are already limitations in the law. And that's the kind of limitation. This is another limitation that's putting in the law. This one says that if you earning at this amount, now we're saying, as we said, that we can easily argue that this is a justifiable limitation. Obviously, we can't even guarantee anything, but we think in the advice that we've received that it can be defended. And that's the issue that we think, but it's up to the committee.
Thank you, sir. I'm mindful of the fact that in terms of the current Labor Relations Act, if the issue that you are challenging is procedural fairness, it's different from substantive fairness. Because if you are challenging substance, then you can say the end result of this dispute has to be reinstatement. That's where then if either the CCMA or anybody who is arbitrating. So the issue here is now once you have that currently in the law, why then this one? Not it being a procedural matter, but at the same time, you continue to argue to say everybody has a right to demand reinstatement, whereas now the law will say you don't have a right to demand reinstatement.
Because Chaplain, yes, that's where they develop. He made the reference when you challenge a defender. He made a very good example. You have been caught back-handed, stealing, and then you are dismissed. And that the substance. So the employees do not have grounds to argue the substance. It's only the procedure that I was not called in a disciplinary hearing. I didn't have enough time to prepare and all those things. And then on the basis of that, the award will be compensation.
What I'm arguing here is this. I mean, the issue that I'm putting is that it's not about what you challenge. Even if you go to the CCMA and challenge both personality and procedural, you challenge both. It's about what the CCMA decides is your case. If the CCMA decides and say, yes, we agree, you will dismiss unfairly in terms of procedure. What we're arguing, that's an unfair dismissal in terms of the law. It's under dismissal. You will dismiss unfairly. You challenge both procedurally and substantive dismissal matter in the CCMA. But the CCMA says, no, no, no. We think on substance, the employer was right. On procedure, the employer is wrong, he didn't follow the procedure. That's in terms of law, it's around unfairness dismissal. It's unfairness. And unfairness has been committed. Doesn't matter for what, the unfairness. Now I'm saying the law puts limitation and says, well, in that case, yes, you agree, it's unfair, you've been unfairly dealt with. In this case, the CCMA can only compensate you. And the argument that I'm making, on principle, technically, if you are going to argue and say, these rights cannot be limited in terms of Section 36. I'm saying I'm not sure whether it's the correct argument because the limitation is already in the law. And the limitation restricts a reinstatement in terms of this issue on unfair dismissal. These are unfair dismissals. It's based on procedure. And then that's what we're saying. And we're saying, on top of that, in the procedure, in the areas around procedure, if the system may find that you are dismissed unfairly because of procedure, you don't have the right to argue in the system and say, well, there are special circumstances for me to be reinstated. In this case, we're putting provision where the senior employee could argue if there are special circumstances for reinstatement. Therefore, it's not a matter of taking reinstatement out of the picture altogether. Because if you look at Section 2AB, it says in any other case, the employee established that there are the circumstances justifying the reinstatement of or re-employment of that employee. Therefore, it's not a matter that says that there can never be re-employment or reinstatement of an employee. It says that the employee has got to make that justification. And that, that's what the proposal says. I'm not saying, I mean, if the committee decides to reject it, but I'm saying that let's look at it in full in terms of the proposal. And I've said that it does not include the issue of retrenchment and the issue of transfer. Those issues are excluded in terms of this.
Okay.
It looks like all the people who are chairing here, they are not chairpersons, they're chairs. They've been taken somewhere else by somebody. Yes, so your head of admin.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to just express agreement with the argument he made in response to Mr. Mkhalipi, because that's exactly our office's position, is that there is a distinction between procedural unfairness and substantive unfairness, and yes, the Labor Relations Act, as it currently reads, does allow certain justifications, but it's on a procedural level, and that really must be seen in a certain context. Procedural unfairness will be, my company's policy says I must give you 4 days to prepare for your hearing, and I gave you 3 days. But that doesn't take away the fact of what substantially happens in that case. So yes, if you did feel, and the commission can then say, but on the facts of the case, that 3 or 4 days would have changed that substantive fact, they will not, then they go into that we will compensate you for procedural unfairness, but the substantive unfairness is not neither here nor there. What our colleagues are proposing with this amendment is something that we can't justify in terms of Section 36, and we disagree with Mr. Malikian on that issue, because Section 36 specifically states you must look at the nature of the right. Now, that's the right to fair life practice everybody has. When you limit that, you look at the importance of the purpose of the limitation. The purpose that the department presented was somebody can't work with somebody else in the context of the business. So that's really an incompatibility issue, but you're now broadening it to take away the substantive issue that if I now dislike somebody, but I'm going to then make something up to say it was misconduct and get rid of him, he can't if that is found to be true, he can't challenge it and accept an exceptional circumstances on a substantive unfairness level. So what you're actually doing is, if I can take the analogy of a criminal case, somebody is, we have the right to be assumed to be innocent if you're charged with something. And the court in certain circumstances says, well, this onus is unfair on the other person who is standing, fighting the full force of the law. Now what you're doing here with the high income earner is you're saying, well, if it's a substantive unfairness thing, because you're a high income earner, you must then argue why you should be allowed access to that right that everybody else has. You must be allowed access to that that substantive unfairness remedy. And we must remember that the courts and the labor court specifically have the power to give a remedy that is just and equitable in the circumstances. Now, Section 36 says we must also consider there is a less restrictive means of achieving the purpose that this provision has in mind. Now, the mischief, as highlighted, is something that, you know, you can't work with this anymore, or the relationship between the employee and the employee isn't of such a nature that they can find it to reconcile. It's almost like a marriage. They're irreconcilable differences. Now, is there a less restrictive means? Yes, the labor court has the power already. You have the structures in place that can dismiss for operational reasons. The court will check, is it really for operational reasons that you are dismissing? Is it really for misconduct? Is it really an issue of incapacity? Or are you using that as a front, as a mere smokescreen to get what you want? And then if it was a smokescreen, then this employer must then do everything, jump through hoops, to prove that he is actually entitled to be heard on a substantive unfairness issue with regard to remedies. We can't see that being justifiable, because as you said, with this extreme unfairness, with this really practical justification purpose, which is already being catered for in a less restrictive fashion. I must also just caution honourable members that when it comes to a constitutional challenge on a bill, I know the department will say they'll defend it, but they are unsighted as the primary party. Parliament will be brought in front of the Constitutional Court as a constitutional challenge to justify this. And as Parliament's legal advisers, we are cautioning that we think there is arbitrary unfairness here. We don't think it's justifiable because there are less restrictive means. The nature of the right here is so important. Our constitution was trendsetting in including the right to fair labour practices within a Bill of Rights for the mere purpose that we see it as so important for everybody, not for selected people. And to exclude it merely on the fact that substantive fairness can now be excluded for remedy purposes because it has been done with procedural fairness, that's really a leap of faith that we can't justify. The impact is just too unfair. So for the same reasons we advise the committee on the rejection of the original clause 38, we advise for the rejection of the new proposed amendments to section 193 and 194. Thank you.
Welcome back. You can take your chair. Yeah, Chairperson, I think in the first place, this is a new section that's proposed by the department. And the reality of the situation, even if we're not at the stage where we say, do we all of us have to vote on this matter to be passed for us to go and present the bill as the Portfolio Committee to Parliament for it to be voted by members. But I think the critical issue here is whether is a new issue that is raised with this committee, what we have to look at is it justifiable?
think it's important on our part to say, please read chapter Bible if it has not entered the processes that it was supposed to, like other sections in the book. But the reality of the situation is that to have a labor relation that says generally CCMA or any tribunal that listens to matters of termination of employment, there are issues that the tribunal must look at, whether is it procedural or substantively unfair. Now, I think it has been qualified in that way. Now, in the same legislation, you have another way of dealing with a particular category of employees. Then that's where it becomes really unfair. And even the legislation now that you are trying to amend, we are losing it. That's why I said earlier, can it be justified with regards to such a legislation? The department is not saying anything in relation to that. They're not pointing to a subsection within section 38 of the Constitution. The example that they are raising is the obvious. That it will be up to the CMA or the Parliament Council or the Labour Court to check whether the dismissal of this employee was procedurally unfair. Then obviously, what does the law say if the dismissal is unprocedural? It's compensated. Because you don't have a substance. It's not substantively unfair. It's procedural. That's what you're fighting for. Obviously, there will be compensation. But in a substance, that where then now you demand a reinstatement because the reasons for your dismissal are unfounded. So now, to have now another way of dismissing is of limiting. Because you're limiting the right by saying, you, by virtue of being in this category, whether you are director general or the CEO, by virtue of you being there, then obviously you are exempted from this labor legislation. So I think that's the issue here. That is the committee we need to be careful of. Thank you, Chairman.
Okay. I don't know if there's anyone who wants to. I think the major dilemma, the two major issues. The first issue is the process that will have to be undergone because this is a new proposal. But I think the second point, which we have always been raising in relation to this discussion, is that everyone should have some form of recourse. And I think with acknowledgement of some of the justifications that the department has made, that there is a particular category, and I think my view was that category should not necessarily be in relation to their earnings, but in relation to authority, the authority they exert within the institution. Because someone can earn R1 million, but they have no particular authority, and someone can earn R50,000, but act on behalf of. And I think also given the major changes in the economy and the fact that sometimes the people who execute managerial responsibilities are not necessarily those who own the institution or company, and that your shareholders are sitting somewhere else, they mandated the person to take responsibility of their company. And in some instances, the whole issue of termination of employment is already built into the contract. Real Madrid just announced that they have amicably, whether that's an amicable resolution or not. I think we see it happen with a lot of CEOs of major companies where the shareholders vote that this CEO is no longer wanted or the senior managers. So you have particular practices, but I think the issue is with that level of authority and acting on behalf of the owner of the institutional company, does or can someone justifiably enjoy certain protection within labor law because they are acting on a managerial level and the kind of power which they possess and they can exert, but alternatively, that everyone should have some form of recourse. And I think that it is one thing that we will have to think about when the minister reintroduces or represent this to us. I think that's the major concern that we have. The point that I think Honorable Nyakemba was raising is very, very crucial. Without being explicit, but the intention of imposing compensation in relation to procedural disputes, I think was born in the fact that substantive issues have also to do with a break in trust and the relationship between them. And that once you cannot satisfy that your employment substantively was unfair, it speaks to trust. And I think that's why the Act imposes compensation in that regard. But I think for now, and I think it has consequences also in terms of the next new clause, but I think let's go through them. Let's go through the next one. So now this is off the table because of that, the fact that it will obviously delay our deliberations of this. But I think just for our benefit, let's also go through that new clause, but with the understanding that mutatis mutandis.
Chair 194 is League 193. It says the same thing that 193 is. If 193 falls away, then 194 falls away also.
That is Mohandis ipso facto. Okay, can we... now agree on the process with regard to this, I think we've basically concluded what we need to deliberate on. There are things which I think we have with ease agreed on. There are things which hopefully they will not take us 6 months to agree on. but I want us to agree on a process, at least on our part as the ANC, we have not really gone through. I think that we have not exhausted the new proposed reformulations. And I think similarly, because we've just presented there have not really been deliberations. That's the first. The second thing is that if we are to go into detail with each and every thing now, we do not have the necessary quorum to agree on those. But the third thing is, and I think if the committee secretary can also discuss this with the chair, that it would be desirable that we have all the political parties which are represented in this committee to be present. We may not have that, I think, given a whole range of other things. And I think the last thing is that we have a budget vote debate tomorrow, which members would want to prepare for. Just to get a sense, when is our next meeting? Thursday at 2, from 2 until 5. Can we agree that on Thursday we will then go through this whole document and then finalize vote?
That's the clause by
clause. That's the clause by clause. And like I said, they may not be as many as they are here because most of the especially the technical linguistic proposed amendments have basically been that which will be easy to go through those. Agreed?
Thanks, Chief. Yes, I will redrop the A list. We did take into account the discussions we had today, and we had to think of the committee basically. But for the purpose of clarity, Chief, how did you take you back again? The one proposal that provided for employment, employee employment, have we agreed to accept that or reject that?
We have agreed to accept
that. Okay, sure.
I don't want to say because if I understood you correctly, you want a situation where all the political parties were then with us in the main. There would be even those that were not with us, but they hold different views on amendments. I think subjects, if the members who are here today argue otherwise, fine, but I think Thursday is too soon. In order for the committee session to make sure that on that particular day, everybody will be here and whatever arrangement they might have, because what is important is that, Chairperson, when we arrange these kinds of meetings, the NC have got many members. So many members, there are EPCs that are taking place now. The office is full. Old council and the E2 for now. So can't we give space for the committee secretary to check with each and every member a day, which there will be no participation in other committees, in order that on that day we know that this is the day that we're looking at this and we'll go cross by cross. Because Thursday 2 to 5 in going clause by clause and take into account the point, the first point that raised out of the three points. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. A bit of logistics and housekeeping, that if that is the way going forward to find a space in the program, just Friday morning is also very attractive for that kind of scenario because lots of committees don't sit on the Friday, but unfortunately Dr. Lewis and I are committed on a Friday morning with the Joint Constitution Review Committee. So if the Friday does seem attractive, we are not available on the Friday morning because that's a joint committee. So just let the committee know that our Friday are out because we have another commitment.
Okay. Yeah. I get what is being raised, and I mean, other than Thursday, the next proposed date is the 28th of May, which has been agreed to by the committee, and also the 29th. I think what we'll do is to ask the secretary to work on getting desirably. I must emphasize, desirably, all the political parties which are members of this portfolio committee. We may not be able to get everybody on board, but I think it's always helpful if we have most people being here. Otherwise, when we get to meet, what suffices is the majority. If the majority of members are present,
something before, if we prefer to go to close vote, what I was saying about those sections that we have not dealt with, those other sections, the sections on the issue about violence, I wouldn't know the clauses exactly. There are those clauses that were not debated, discussed at all. Maybe that we need to start there, finalize that discussion, and also hold out this issue of 6 months, whether it's 6 months, 2 months, and what, and then so that we can have a complete document when we go to that meeting that we finalize the issue.
Okay. I'm assuming that without necessarily going back into the deliberations when we get into the specific clause by clause, that we would say, all right, the tax proposal is 6 months. What do we say? Month, 12 months, 0 months. That's my assumption.
I mean, if we are going on the aid list, should then I'm assuming that the aid list will consist of all the clauses,
yes.
Starting from the first clause, and those clauses where we have not debated them, we will then.
The aid list only has the amendments the committee proposed. At this stage, but there was the other clauses that important to put in are clauses which the committee had to come to any sort of consensus regarding that or any sort of proposal. So they parked that, so that is in the parking lot.
Okay.
So those clauses haven't been dealt with and therefore they're not in the proposed A-list. The proposed A-list are only the ones with those clauses which was discussed in there, but the parking lot clauses which hasn't been, a decision hasn't been taken on, has been parked, are not included in the A-list. So that is all in the bowl as it is.
Okay.
And can we?
Yeah.
I agree with the technical advisor that what is the A-list with as we went through and all the technical things. I think the things that were parked are policy issues, substantive issues that I agree with the chair. When we get to clause C, and this was the issues that the members then say, what is our position, and we agree or take that out. But, and that was the discussion that would happen at that time as we're going through the clause. But those aren't issues that are actually A-list. From my understanding where we are today after today's meeting, the A-list is substantially done, given taken what's happened from today's meeting and that must be cleaned up. But I don't think that before our next meeting there's anything else that needs to go into the A-list.
I think what we could do just for refresher purposes, we could extract those issues which we said, let's put them on the pact. As a to note, you know, we don't necessarily have to go straight into them, you know, and I think the easiest way in which we will be able to deal with this would be, I think this document will be extremely helpful, you know, to look at what is it that we have agreed on, what is it that we haven't. And then on the basis of that, then take off, make proposals. And there would obviously be reformulations depending on what we agree on in terms of policy issues. So I don't know who's going to be doing that.
Yeah, so that was important that, because it's important that those issues be sort of brought to the stage when the committee said that, okay, we are going to take this and we need to reformulate. So they need to get some sort of solution because if it's forgotten on the wayside, you'll see it as, next month, how clear in the top of the act. And then you'll see that it's still in here, you'll see the things we haven't talked about, if we haven't discovered, we haven't discussed. So there's a risk of that, but you don't have to be many documents about that. I think it's maybe now we have some discussions of the over done, so when we try to put the A's, we can refine and reformulate it also. And my concern is if you meet in the past, not in the forgotten, and then it will automatically be part of the
No, but what we're saying is we have this as the A list. And we... Yes, and this, and that we would effectively literally go through this so that nothing is left to chance, and we ask if we are all agreed with the formulation in the submission as is or whatever, which means that the reworking of this as discussed today would it will only be about things that we have agreed on, the formulations that we have agreed on,
you know, and then we will cross-reference to these two documents. So I don't think anything will be left. But I think just to refresh ourselves so that even when we go to our different caucuses, we need to ask someone to extract the issues which were put on the parking list, so that we also remember those. And then we don't say, no, we didn't discuss that. Yeah. Are you able to help us with it?
We'll do that.
Yes, but we need to take
it. Yeah, okay. Yes. And I think it's mainly issues which are referred to in tablet policy decision, final policy decision.
But some of them are already dealt with.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Sorry, Chair.
Oh, yeah.
Chair, with the committee's permission then, perhaps I can just clean up this document before the start of the day, and then email it to the committee secretary for distribution to the members.
Yeah, so we'll get this cleaned up and this cleaned up, and then, yeah, okay, all right, thank you very much. I understand that the lunch, if you can just indicate where and all of that. Okay, but other than that, The next meeting, I think we'll agree that Thursday is not going to work. And the next date is Tuesday and Wednesday. Hopefully the EPCs will be done, I think.
No.
Is it?
It's got to be other than
getting the other members from the other party. The important thing is they need to know that when they will meet, so that even if they don't come, they will send apologies or they cannot say this, that we were not informed yet. That's very important. Yeah.
Okay, so in order for us to have the full participation, there's a view that way for the EPCs to call. My view is let's leave the schedule for Tuesday, next week, Tuesday and Wednesday. Let's make an assessment in terms of confirmations, and then we will then take it from there. Thank you very much, colleagues, friends, and comrades. Yeah. Orange is apparently here.
I'm going to go to the next one. I'd like to order.
Yes, I know.
some people are saying that they want more rights to the people. They are the permanent, they are the they don't want the same rights. No, they're getting people, they want to move to settings of the people's land, you know, because it's not quite rich land. Which is rich land, what we're supposed to be looking at the
Thank you.